Religious fundamentalists and left-wing secularists might have more in common than you think. A new report for the United Nations says both can endanger the rights of women. And the Victorian Parliament takes the first step to approving assisted suicide. But is euthanasia only for the painfully ill, or also for those who've simply tired of life? I'm Andrew West. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. The United Nations General Assembly will receive a damning report on the way religious fundamentalism and extreme nationalism are endangering the rights and even the lives of women. But the report's author, the UN Special Rapporteur on Cultural Rights, Karima Bannoun, doesn't spare the secular left. She says that in the name of cultural sensitivity, some Western human rights groups have ignored the persecution of women. Nor does her report spare Australia, where she warns that radical views on race and religion are becoming mainstream. I spoke with Karima Bannoun.
I was very concerned looking around the world at the rise of different forms of fundamentalism within all of the world's great religious traditions. So certainly I had been watching with alarm the horrific abuses committed by Daesh or the so-called Islamic State, but also proliferating fundamentalist movements in other places. But I have to say also a number of events in the West, including the backlash against migrants and people speaking foreign languages, say, in the United Kingdom after the Brexit vote, the killing of Jo Cox, the young woman parliamentarian in the UK, the rise of really a hateful discourse after the elections in the United States last fall. And the point of the report is to try to look at them in a global context and understand the threat that they represent to women's cultural rights specifically.
Yeah, Australia gets, well, let us say, a dishonourable mention in this report. What was the reason to look even briefly at Australia?
So we called for submissions to the report. We asked governments and civil society around the world to inform us of their concerns in this area. And indeed, we did receive a submission from an Australian NGO called Australian Lawyers for Human Rights that expressed its concern with what it saw as a mainstreaming of some extremist ideas in Australian public discourse and with what it was calling a rise in populist ultra-nationalism that in its view was trying to impose a so-called authentic Australian culture on women, especially those from diverse ethnic backgrounds. And I have to mention, this is, you know, really only one of a number of country issues that were raised based on submissions, but I do think it's important to have it in there to show that this is, you know, a problem that people are confronting in different ways, really in every region.
Yeah. Your report studies and condemns religious fundamentalists and extremists. So how do you define them? Who are we talking about here, Karima?
I have cited the definition of the Algerian feminist sociologist Mariamme Elie Lucas, who describes fundamentalisms as political movements of the extreme right that in a context of globalization manipulate religion to achieve their political aims. So we're talking about movements that are basically using a particular, often rather virulent interpretation of religion as a mechanism to take power either in society or in the polity. For example, the Hindu right, which is in power in India, using a particular vision of Hinduism, which has very rigid notions of, you know, what India should look like, and really using that against other people, Hindus and of Hindu descent who disagree with that, but also especially against religious minorities. We're seeing it lead to violence against Muslims in particular.
You talk there about movements of the extreme religious right, but as you and I have talked about before, how do sometimes movements of the secular left end up justifying those movements of the religious right? Because your report for the UN condemns what you call, quote, unacceptable cultural relativist excuses. And I found that fascinating.
We are finding that other forces that are perhaps not themselves fundamentalist sometimes give in to the fundamentalist messages in the name of what the fundamentalists themselves claim, which is that their view is authentic, actually in the name of cultural rights. And I think that that does a terrible disservice to the women who are fighting for their rights within these different religious traditions, who have every right to the equal human rights guaranteed by human rights law. And clearly, my mandate on cultural rights has made clear from the very beginning that cultural rights and cultural relativism are not the same thing. Cultural rights are not a justification for violations of human rights or for discrimination. And I think it really undermines the struggle for women's equal cultural rights when people kind of give in to the arguments that the fundamentalists make here, that they are the authentic voice.
Yeah, your report says no religion is inherently fundamentalist. So who's hijacked these religions?
You know, I think it's a question of, as I describe them in the report, what are almost invariably minority movements within the broader religious traditions, though sometimes they may have some broader support. And what we're seeing again and again, and this is both with the religious fundamentalist movements and with the other forms of extremist movements not drawing from a religious space, we're seeing these similarities. They often say they represent the authentic culture, which is superior, which is monolithic, that they're sort of campaigning for a kind of purity, whether it's national or ethnic or religious purity. And what we're finding again and again in all these contexts is that women human rights defenders are often at the forefront of challenging these fundamentalist and extremist movements. And what I say in the report is they need international support to succeed.
Where is that international support, frankly, failing? Because, you know, you say that some civil society and human rights communities, people that we often associate, as I've said, with the secular left, are not uniting to fight fundamentalism. They're falling back on this idea that any criticism of these practices might be racist, for example. So where is the failure to back up the women human rights defenders in these religions?
I think that's a very important question, and I think it comes at a number of different levels. It often comes from governments around the world in different regions. When governments themselves make cultural relativist arguments that undermine universality, when they, for example, enter reservations to the UN Women's Convention based on cultural relativist justifications of discrimination against women, they are basically aiding and abetting extremism. When they fail to protect women human rights defenders who are under threat from diverse extremist and fundamentalist movements, whether it's from far-right movements or whether it's from religious fundamentalists in other parts of the world, they are aiding and abetting extremism. So sometimes the failure comes at the level of government, and I make a number of recommendations as to how government can better take on this issue. Sometimes the failure has come from, I'll be very honest, the UN system itself, which has not, I think, had a systematic approach to the question of fundamentalism and extremism, and that's something that I'm calling for. And sometimes the failures have come from civil society, and I'm calling on the human rights movements around the world, especially those at the international level. Many at the national and regional level have recognized this issue and are campaigning around it, but I've really called on the international human rights movement to recognize the threat that fundamentalism and extremism pose to the cultural rights of women and to support the human rights defenders on the front lines. This is a universal human rights struggle.
Can we put some names to it, Karima? I mean, is it Human Rights Watch? Is it Amnesty International? I mean, who is failing to rally in support of women human rights defenders across all the religions?
I think it's more of a systematic problem within the field of human rights of having been very nervous to tackle the issue of ideology and the negative impact that ideology can have on human rights. And the international community recognized that back in the era of apartheid, that the problem wasn't just the abuses attendant on apartheid, it was the ideology of racial superiority itself that had to be defeated. And I think that's what we're seeing here. It is these extremist and fundamentalist ideologies ideologies themselves that have to be tackled in accordance with international standards. We have to be very careful because of also this can become an excuse for governments themselves to violate human rights. We see in you know, countries like Turkey, where now the label extremist itself is being used against civil society, against the very people themselves who have been campaigning, in fact, against actual extremism. So I think what we really see here is a broader systemic problem. And, you know, we have to be willing to take on this issue. I mean, otherwise, the youth of the world are going to see a very bleak landscape where what they have is simply sort of a choice of competing extremisms, Muslim fundamentalism or far-right extremism in the West, Hindu fundamentalism or Christian fundamentalism. I mean, we really have to offer better choices than that. And that's what human rights is about.
Yeah, that is a bleak prognosis. It's the Religion and Ethics Report. Andrew West with you. I'm speaking with Professor Karima Bannoun. She's the UN Special Rapporteur for Cultural Rights and the author of a new report that will be presented to the UN General Assembly. Karima, the effects of violent fundamentalism and extremism are obvious. I mean, we saw this in the attacks on the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester and the terrorism in Paris and Nice. But why are you worried as much about non-violent extremism as you are about violent extremism?
I am skeptical of this concept of so-called nonviolent extremism, and we're often seeing that in many places where governments have strategies for what is called combating violent extremism, they sometimes base those strategies on partnering with what they deem to be nonviolent extremists or quote-unquote moderate extremists or fundamentalists of various stripes. And I think this is a terrible mistake because I think the extremist and fundamentalist violence that we see, whether it is, you know, white supremacist violence in the United States or violence against Roma in Eastern Europe, that violence is based on an underlying ideology. Often these so-called nonviolent extremists actually espouse the discourse, which is part of what gives rise to the violence. And most often they espouse a discourse of discrimination against women that has very dire consequences for women and in fact ends up producing a great deal of violence against women. So it's actually often not that nonviolent at all. And I think the real partners to seek out in the struggle against fundamentalism and extremism are actually human rights defenders who are challenging these ideologies.
So what's a classic case, Karima, of a government or governments or an international organization, transnational organization, using nonviolent extremism in what they believe is the quest to defeat violent extremism?
I'm not going to single out one government here. I'm afraid this is a fairly widespread problem. We see it, for example, in the kinds of people who get invited to some of the international meetings about terrorism. We see it in the kinds of organizations that governments often partner with. We see it in their effort to reach out to so-called community leaders who are often self-appointed, very often men who may espouse, in fact, quite discriminatory interpretations of religion, who may in fact themselves support fairly fundamentalist approaches to religion that are having a very negative consequence for women. And we often see that, you know, those are deemed the partners or the bulwark against fundamentalism and extremism, not the women human rights defenders. You know, and I wish I could just point to one country, but I really think it's a systemic problem that needs to be addressed.
Well, could I point, for example, to Saudi Arabia, which officially doesn't fund ultra-violent extremist groups, but we all know the money is raised there. Would I be on the wrong track?
I do address in this report and in the previous report, which was generally about fundamentalism and extremism, not just looking at women's cultural rights, the very important issue about the funding from second countries for fundamentalist and extremist movements around the world, and that we absolutely have to tackle that issue, and there has to be accountability for the human rights violations that result. And I noted that in the Human Rights Council meeting in March, it was interesting, there was very strong support on that particular point from the government of Libya, which, of course, its country has been very gravely affected by foreign support for extremist groups. So I think that that is an issue that absolutely has to be tackled. And it again, is broader than simply one country, though you certainly have mentioned a very important country example to consider.
Yeah. Your report looks at all religious extremism. You talk about the Hindu purdah restrictions, the dress requirements for some ultra-Orthodox Jewish women. But I do want to ask you about the very detailed comments you make about the imposition, including by something called the European Council of Fatwas and Research, of an edict on Muslim women to cover their heads. Now, you're a Muslim woman. We've spoken about this before, Karima, and you wrote about this in your book, Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here. What's the problem with that fatwa that was issued by this European Council?
I try to tackle in the report an issue that I know is going to be a sensitive one, and perhaps many states won't wish to talk about it, but it is one of the forms of what I call cultural engineering that we've seen used by diverse religious fundamentalists in particular, and that is the imposition of what is called modest dress on women and the sort of normalization of that dress at the expense, very often, in fact, of local traditional dress. I give the example of the kinds of pressures that women have faced that have really led to a sort of a significant change in the cultural choices that are available to them. And the one example to which you referred comes from a particular non-governmental organization called the European Council of Fatwas and Research. And it's quite a shocking fatwa in which they said that all women in Europe, in fact, have to veil, basically so that they present themselves as serious and honest women who are neither seductresses nor temptresses. You know, I try to give this as an example of the kinds of social pressures that are placed on women really systemically to change their cultural choices about how they dress, and that very often in the diverse contexts, whether it's some of the ultra-Orthodox Judaism that we're seeing now, whether it's in one particular sect of Mormonism, where in fact at the moment we are seeing sort of increasing pressure on women for modest dress. We see some Hindu fundamentalist vigilantism in this regard. I think all too often this is simply written off as a matter of choice. And certainly one does think that people's free cultural choices about dress, men or women, are very important. However, you know, the problem is, how are these choices being constructed when people are being told that if you make certain choices, you're basically a bad adherent of your religious tradition?
Professor Karima Bannoun is the UN Special Rapporteur on Cultural Rights, and her report is to be presented today to the UN General Assembly. Karima is also the author, as you may recall, of the book Your Fatwa Does Not Apply Here. Thanks for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report, Karima.
Thank you so much.
It's almost 100 years since Australians fighting with the British Army defeated the Turks at the Battle of Beersheba in what is today Israel, but was then Ottoman Syria. The British and the French then divided up the Middle East between them, the so-called Sykes-Picot Agreement. But when they drew lines on the map to create the modern Middle East, they also stoked much of the religious conflict we see today. From Jerusalem, Iris Mackler spoke with Hebrew University historian Alon Kadish.
The British troops and the Australian and New Zealand troops, of course, chasing out the Turks from here was the first time in hundreds of years since the Crusaders that there had been non-Muslim rule in this area. Is that significant, do you think?
At the time, it had some significance, especially in propaganda. In the search for meaning and justification, one of the main justifications in the case of the Middle East was a new crusade of replacing the Turks as the rulers of, in this case, the Holy Land. But the war wasn't only the Holy Land, the war was the whole Middle East. But as far as Palestine was concerned, the imagery, including some of the memorials, are associated directly with the Crusades. For instance, the memorial for the surrender of Turkish Jerusalem to the British has images of Crusaders on it. It's part of the attempt to romanticize the war, provide it with some sort of a meaning which is beyond the crass interests of the sides involved. And Crusaders had a very good image in still in English culture. Not so much in Jewish culture, but that's...
Or in Muslim culture,
that's true.
Do you think there would have been a state of Israel, you know, all these what-ifs, if the Ottomans hadn't been chased out of here?
Doubtful. But I think an historian can afford only one if. In other words, one crossroads of decisions. When you go beyond that, there are too many variables. So if it's narrowed down to the question of would the state of Israel been born within the Turkish Empire, questionable, but the Turkish Empire was disintegrating. So it could be that in the process of disintegration, the map would have changed, but there weren't enough Jews in Palestine to really sustain their own state, not until the British rule.
Okay, so we were talking about the map. How is the map different after the end of World War I and after the British victories here?
Okay. The initial division, which determined the borders, was based on the old notion, imperial notion, of areas of interest. An arbitrary line was drawn on the map, and north of that would be French, and south of the line is British zone of interest. And this is how the world has been divided by the empires. However, following the agreement, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was signed during the war, there's this change in the goals of the war, largely due to the American insistence that would join the war unless these principles were accepted. Principles such as self-determination, which have to do with the whole idea of a nation state. Now, the concept is completely alien to the Middle East. It didn't have anything resembling, at least not on a large scale, anything like these ethnic entities. So the idea was to take the areas divided by the great powers and give them a different status, their mandates. They're given to France or Britain by the League of Nations, and the idea of the mandate is to prepare them for independence so they can become nation states. And so you have these states, or officially states, with all the trappings of a modern European, West European state, with a national anthem and a flag and a constitution and a press and parliament and what have you. And you can see it now in Syria and Iraq. Very little has remained of it.
I did notice that ISIS, when they were first formed, and then they, now they've lost their caliphate, but they were setting up a caliphate in Iraq and Syria. And they said, this is the end of Sykes-Picot. That was what they boasted.
Because the idea is to erase the borders, the artificial borders, and replace it with something else, which is as romantic.
When Britain created Transjordan and Iraq, did they pay any attention to Sunni and Shia at all?
No, very little, very little. The division there was political.
So let me ask you, the heirs to all of this were Arab dictators. That's what took over.
Yeah, but one of the only ways of holding on to these artificial borders is through dictatorship, through totalitarianism.
Do you think Mr. Sykes and Mr. Picot, do you think they had any idea what they were creating?
No, because they were thinking in terms of the empires. And this is the way the empires rule the world.
And not just that, it's also where you draw your borders. That's why I was thinking about Sunni and Shia also, because they would draw a line.
The borders are arbitrary and there's no common denominator, common ethnic denominator, which is strong enough within most of these borders.
And the opposite, you've got enemies within many of these borders.
Yeah, it's because, well, anyway, traditional enemies or ethnic enemies.
So was the result of World War I good, do you think?
Look, for Israel, or for the Jewish people, it was very good because it was one more step towards sovereignty. In terms of the world at large, it was a disastrous war, a terrible war.
Was it good that the Brits chased the Turks out of here? Was that a good result, actually?
In the medium run, yes. The British were better rulers than the Turks. and certainly did much more to develop the area, although it wasn't the British taxpayers' money, but local taxes, but allowed development of the local economy. And there are many who think they should have remained longer. But in terms of that fairly narrow perspective, yeah. And thank you for the Australians and New Zealanders for helping. They were always more popular in Palestine than the British soldiers.
Really?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There was great fondness towards the Australians and New Zealanders because of their general behavior, which was much more friendly. And also they consumed more beer, and which was good for the local economy because the beer was local. But there were always reservations towards the memory of the British military presence in Palestine. Nothing at all on any similar scale towards the Australians and New Zealanders.
Historian Alon Kadish speaking with Iris Mackler. Next week, Victoria's Upper House of Parliament will debate a bill to allow medically assisted suicide for terminally ill patients. The bill has already passed the lower house. Similar legislation is planned for the New South Wales Parliament later this year. The Victorian Premier, Daniel Andrews, calls the proposal for voluntary euthanasia the most conservative of its type in the world. Xavier Simmons is with the Institute for Ethics and Society at Notre Dame University and was until recently at the UHERO Centre for Practical Ethics at Oxford University.
One of the issues with euthanasia legislation is that it's an inherently difficult medical intervention, if you will, a procedure to regulate. In the end, you're ending the life of a patient, or you're prescribing drugs that will allow the patient to end their life. And there's so many different points, I suppose, along the way during that process where various kinds of deleterious issues can occur. So, for example, issues of coercion from a family when they're trying to discuss end-of-life options with a patient who's terminally ill, and whether there's issues of duress there or coercion. Issues as well of the actual consumption of the drug and whether it's going to be safe to allow patients to consume the barbiturates in an environment outside of a hospital without a medical professional present.
Well, you've looked at this issue closely both here but also in your work at Oxford University. Let me ask you about some of the so-called tripwires in this. So the scheme will be open. This is the voluntary assisted dying scheme as proposed in the legislation. You'd have to be aged over 18, suffering an incurable illness with a life expectancy of less than 12 months. You'd have to be of sound mind and be able to give yourself the drug unless you've got something that prevents self-medication. And you'd need to ask a medical professional three times, including in writing. Would they be enough tripwires?
I think, Andrew, it is a particularly conservative model as far as extant legislation goes around the world, and they are significant safeguards. They're not safeguards that are going to be futile. They will prevent abuses of the law. They will prevent coercion in various situations, I suppose, that one can find oneself in at the end of life.
Now, you've rejected some of the more dramatic arguments that a bill like this is the slippery slope to the sort of euthanasia that was enforced, you know, by the Nazis. You've said that's an invalid and very alarmist proposition. But there are some so-called slippery slope arguments that you say are valid. What are those?
Sure. So I think an invalid slippery slope argument is, yes, something like that if we were to legalise euthanasia in Victoria, we will shortly be in a situation similar to Nazi Germany, that involuntary euthanasia will become the norm or something like that. I think that's manifestly false and invalid. I think there are arguments in regard to the normalisation of euthanasia and the effect that legalisation has on attitudes towards euthanasia in society that can be situated, I suppose, in the context of a slippery slope argument. Say, for example, in Belgium, where euthanasia was legalised quite some time ago, over a decade ago. And since then, there has been a steady increase in the number of deaths by virtue of euthanasia, indicating a normalisation of that way of dying in society. But how is this a slippery slope argument? Well, one can, for example, refer to the fact that euthanasia for children of any age was legalised in Belgium in 2014. And one can actually look at the arguments that were marshalled in favour of the legislation. And you can see that a lot of that is the effect of the normalisation of the process in society. So the idea that there's a rational connection or some sort of causal connection or probabilistic connection between event A, legalisation under certain circumstances of euthanasia, and event B, a kind of augmentation of the law, is, I think, plausible to some degree. Obviously, there are kind of social dynamics that are complex and society is different. Australian society is very different to the Benelux region, but nevertheless, I think there is something to be said for those examples from countries or jurisdictions where euthanasia is already legal.
Well, particularly in the case of Belgium, where initially people were assured that children would not be taking part in euthanasia. It would not be for children. And as you say, 3 years ago, it was legalised for children. I also noticed that in the Netherlands, the procedure which began in 2002, 1.3% of deaths were by euthanasia or assisted suicide. I think it's almost trebled in the Netherlands.
That's correct, yes. So in the Benelux region, or at least in the Netherlands, the rates of euthanasia have increased quite dramatically over the past decade since, I suppose, the procedure was legalised and seen as something sort of as exceptional, if you will. So around 3.7% of all the deaths in the Netherlands in 2015 were by virtue of euthanasia or suicide, and that's up by 1.3 from when the procedure was legalised in 2002. Now, there's the added issue I might just quickly add, Andrew, whether that's a bad thing. So euthanasia advocates may not think that's a bad thing, and they may think this is actually euthanasia being kind of from the Greek origin, a good death. That may actually be a good thing, that more people are availing themselves of this way of dying. But nevertheless, it remains for society to make up their minds about whether we're comfortable with, say, for example, in 20 years' time, 5 to 10% of deaths in Australia occurring by virtue of euthanasia or assisted suicide.
Yes, as you point out in a piece that you wrote recently for The Conversation, some pro-euthanasia advocates do see normalisation as a positive good. What about the argument that euthanasia may end up taking hold among people who don't face an excruciating period of pain, but have simply tired of life?
That's a really good question to ask, I think, in the context of the current debate. There's a sort of broader issue, right, behind euthanasia and assisted suicide as an end-of-life option, and that is that what exactly is euthanasia and assisted suicide answering to? Is it answering to the fact that someone has a terminal illness? Is it answering to the fact that someone is in pain? Mm. Or is it answering to something deeper, something like, for example, a loss of control, a sense of feeling that one's a burden, or a sense of existential suffering? I think that it's actually the latter. I think that's sort of the tenor of the debate, if you will, the arguments that are being made in favour of euthanasia in Australia at the moment. And I think there's an issue there because it does lend itself to an augmentation of the law, or arguments in favour of an augmentation of the law, to consider, for example, those who are tired of life and suffering unbearably because they're tired of life. We're witnessing that at the moment in the Netherlands, where the Ministry of Health is considering legislation to allow euthanasia for those who are tired of life and suffering unbearably.
Xavier Simmons of the Institute for Ethics and Society, ending today's Religion and Ethics report. And you can find our stories at the RN website or via the ABC Listen app, iTunes, or wherever you get your favourite podcasts. Thanks to Nadia El Ghorli and Jolan Camilleri. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.